And thank to the organizers for putting together this great opportunity to share different perspectives on contextuality. I feel I really learned a lot, and we are only at the second day, so that's wonderful. So I'm going to talk about a physical picture, so that's a kind of more friendly way to talk about axioms and axiomatics, but I will try to remain a little bit friendly and talk about what is the picture behind the axioms, more than doing like hardcore axiomatics here. So this slide, okay, is about the problem that we all love and care about. It's a problem of contextuality, as started by Koshin and Specker. Well, that's pretty much the introduction you already heard a few times. So this is one of the most fundamental non-classical features that we have in quantum mechanics. And on a practical side, is also a resource for quantum information processing. So what does it mean, besides that this is kind of the standard thing that we would say at the beginning of our talks? It means that it's good to understand it for the purpose of understanding the foundations of quantum mechanics. So it's important to understand how contextuality works. And it's also good to understanding from a practical point of view, because it's good to have a handle, some guiding principles, or some idea of how to use contextuality to do things in quantum information processing. So there are two motivations for caring about what is the picture behind contextuality. One is foundational, and one is kind of more practical and more operational. So the talk is about the physical picture for contextuality. So what I'm trying to say is that we would like to understand in a more principled way contextuality. So there are two fundamental questions that come from quantum contextuality. Question number one is like, why is nature contextual at all? And question number two is more specific and more quantitative. Why is nature contextual in the particular way it is contextual in quantum theory? So why do we have the particular amount of contextuality that we have in quantum theory? So these are two questions that are not about quantum theory. So they are about how the world could have been if it had not been the way it is. So in order to answer these questions, we need to go outside quantum theory. So you cannot answer the questions within quantum theory. I mean, you can. You could say nature is contextual because that's quantum theory, and quantum theory is contextual. But these kind of answers are going to be cheap. So if you want to have an answer that is kind of deeper and more interesting, you need to go outside and to venture outside the realm of quantum theory. So how to do this practically? Well, if you want to go outside quantum theory, you need at least two things. We need a framework to talk about what are the possible alternatives. So how could the world have been if it had not been the way it is, the way that is described by quantum theory? So we need a sort of mathematical framework to talk about alternative theories. Another thing that we need is a set of physical principles, and I use the word physical in a pretty general way. So we need some principles that look like appealing principles in this framework, and they would determine what is the amount of contextuality we have in quantum theory. For first, a broad framework. First, we have to make things broad, and then we have to narrow them down. Right, so we go outside quantum theory, make things broad, and then try to go back to quantum theory with principles. And that's the kind of general philosophy. So what is the state of the art? So we do have a framework. It's broadly called the framework of general probabilistic theories, or GPTs. This is a very broad terminology. There are actually different frameworks that go under the same name. But I will refer to one of them, and the differences are not important really for this talk. So we do have a framework to talk about theories that are not quantum theory or that are not classical theory. And we do have principles from which we can derive quantum theory. So somehow problem solved. So let's go home. You don't need to give this talk. So there are axiomatizations of quantum theory that do pretty much this job. In the kind of quantum information approach, the starting point was Hardy 2001. Then there has been other works that developed from this line. Pretty close to the original axioms of Hardy, there are Bruckner and Dakich, Massanes and Müller. Then there was, well, the axiomatization of my co-authors and myself. In 2010, we proposed some different axioms, different from Lucien's ones. Lucien himself came up with different axioms in 2011, very different from the ones of 2001. So it's a very different axiomatization. Wiles also had a very interesting axiomatization about composite systems and steering. And another one is more recent by Barnum, Müller, and Ududek in 2015. That's not a complete list. That's just a list of the things that kind of I found more striking when I saw the result. So we do have axiomatization. So why do we care about finding new axioms? Well, just because we would like... I forgot to make a little bit of an advertisement. So the one that we did is just the subject of a book that has just been published by Cambridge University Press. So there is a book published in 2017 that is kind of the expanded version of our axiomatization work. And that's my advertisement, end of it. So why do we? What is missing in the existing axiomatizations? Well, there are matter of tastes missing. So there are things that we may want to have better axioms. On a more serious way, I think what is missing for contextuality, for the purpose of this meeting, is that it would be nice to have a more direct understanding of contextuality. So instead of telling you I have axioms, from the axioms I derive quantum theory, from quantum theory you derive the amount of contextuality, it would be nice to have axioms that tell us something directly about contextuality, like why do we have it, and how much of it do we have. So direct is the key word. I think we would like to have a more direct understanding of contextuality and also possibly a more compelling understanding of contextuality. This is a subjective figure of merit. Everybody has a different understanding of what compelling is, but I think it's kind of everybody would agree that in some sense we want to have more compelling axioms, at least for contextuality. That's where we are. So what do we get more in this talk? I will give you three things in this talk. So the first is a definition, actually, of contextuality in GPTs, in general probabilistic theories. The second thing I will give you is a physical principle, or a principle, that bounds contextuality in every general probabilistic theory. And the third thing I will give you is a physical picture, which means a heuristics. Not a theorem, just a general outlook about that we can use to understand the origin of contextuality. Okay, so that's these two are pretty well mathematically defined things. The picture is more like the inspiration and the outlook of what I'm doing. And because of that, I give you the picture first, and then I will do the kind of more mathematical things. So the key idea of all the work I've been doing actually in foundations, since now, is the idea of the purification principle, of the purification philosophy. So roughly the idea is this, that you can have some non-ideal feature that you observe in the lab, could be part of your experience as an experimentalist or as an observer. And the important idea here is that these non-ideal features can always be removed if you look at a bigger system. So you can enlarge the set of systems that you describe in your theory. And by this enlargement, you can go from some non-ideal feature to some ideal feature. Here I'm being very high level. I didn't tell you which features I'm talking about. But this is kind of the philosophy. This is the general principle that is guiding the work that I'm describing to you. So more concretely, if you wanted to go to talk about the basic building blocks of a general probabilistic theory, of these physical theories, the basic building blocks are states, evolutions, and measurements. So what do I mean by non-ideal? For states, it's kind of clear that we usually mean mixed states, states that describe a kind of non-maximal knowledge about the systems, states that where there is some empirical ignorance about our system. For the evolutions, the non-ideal feature I refer to is irreversibility. So we do observe irreversible evolutions. For the measurement, this feature is unsharpness. For some of you, this may mean already something. If it doesn't mean anything now, don't worry, because this is the core of the talk. So I will actually, part of the talk is to give a definition of what I mean here by unsharp, but for the moment, just take it as some non-ideal feature. And the idea of the purification philosophy is that mixed states can be dilated or extended to pure states. Irreversible processes can, in principle, be extended to reversible processes, and unsharp measurement can, in principle, be extended to sharp measurements. So that's the broad picture. About more concrete things, in papers, we did study the first two things in two papers with Mauro Dariano and Paolo Perinotti. The first was in 2010, PRA, and the second is the axiomatization paper in 2011. This was about purification of states and the reversibilization of processes. There was nothing really about sharp measurements here. Sharp measurement came later, and this is actually the work part of the work I'm presenting today. So this third part came later in a work with Xiao Yuan, who was a student at Tsinghua University. So again, what is this picture going to tell about contextuality? My way of looking at this is that the first two parts, the fact that you can purify states and make irreversible evolutions reversible, is what will bring contextuality in. So the reason why we have different contexts, loosely speaking, is that we have to create space for more states than what the states that we would have classically. We need that if we want to purify. On the other hand, the sharpness, the fact that you want to make measurements more powerful and more ideal, will make things more classical. So this is somehow the source of the limitations on the amount of contextuality. So to make a little bit of a slogan, I would say that the purification is what brings contextuality in this picture, and sharpness is what cuts it down. Again, these are very high-level things, no theorem proven yet, but I want to give you first the ideas and then the theorems, so that you can judge how much the theorems match the ideas. Just to give you some heuristics also about this, what I just said. So why purification would imply contextuality? Well, because from purification you get the fact that you need pure entangled states. So if you want to purify a mixed state, extend it to a pure state, you need an entangled state. These states are entangled, so they are not product. So they are not in the basis of product states that you could find if you combine the local states of composite systems. So the fact that you have entanglement tells you that you must have complementary basis, whatever basis means here. And this is what is going to tell you that you will not have a single context, not a single property to look at in this heuristic way. So that's for like why purification brings contextuality in. On sharpness, so sharpness will contain an ideal of minimal disturbance. So this ideal feature of sharpness contains the fact that when you make a measurement, you make the minimal disturbance you could possibly make. And this will imply consistency conditions on the contexts, and this will reduce, will put bounds on the amount of contextuality. So this is my heuristics for why purification brings contextuality in and why sharpness will cut it down. Okay. Okay, so that was the broad picture. So now I'm really going to set up the scene for more rigorous and mathematically precise notions. So let me give a little bit of preliminaries, like my short crash course on what I understood about contextuality. And I'm not one of the top experts in these things, so just take this for what it is. So what is contextuality? First of all, there are many different notions for it. We have learned a lot about this yesterday, in particular about Rob's new generalized notion, as opposed to the Cauchy-Specker notion about projective measurements. So today I will talk about actually the old Cauchy-Specker notion, not because I'm taking sides in any wars, but because I had something to say about this. So I'm just talking about this because I had something that resonated with that point of view. So I will adopt one of the paradigms that you saw about contextuality is the graph theoretic framework, or if you want to be more friendly, we can call it the question and answer framework that started from Cabello, Severini, Winter, and then it was developed more by Assin, Fritz, Le Verrier, and our chairman, Annabel Ensign. So I will adopt this framework as it is. The idea is that the experimentalist, the experimenter asks questions to nature, and nature gives answers back. So you can imagine there is a device. You throw the question into the device, and you get an answer out of the device. What describes the behavior of nature is a conditional probability distribution, is a distribution of the answer given the question. And in a fancy way, we can call this nature's strategy to answer your questions. So this is the response strategy of nature. So which kind of questions do we ask here? So the notion of Cauchy-Specker contextuality here is whether nature has a predefined strategy to answer. So whether nature knows the answer before you ask the question. So in this sense, contextuality is really about predetermination of the properties of the answers to these questions. Is there a strategy to answer to the question where the answers are predetermined? And now we are talking about that, which is one particular way to look at contextuality. It's not the only way, but as I said, this is the way where I have something to tell for the moment. So this, more mathematically, we can set this in the graph theoretic framework. So the question X can be seen as a set. So the set is just the set of all possible answers to that question, and the answer is an element of the set. Here is an example. Here there are three questions, the blue, the red, and the green question. Each question consists of three answers, and, well, each answer is an element of the set. Mathematically, this is a hypergraph. There is a constraint on the strategies that nature can use. We demand that when nature answers a question, we'll always answer with the same probability for the same question, for the same answer, no matter in which question the answer appeared. This was called by Rob response non-contextuality. So we are assuming, am I right? Yes. So we are assuming this from the outset. We are assuming non-contextuality in that sense from the outset. What we ask now is a question about predetermination. We are asking whether or not the answer Y is compatible with a picture where nature had a predefined answer before.
Yep. Now that I've caught a beat, no, that's not a notion of non-contextuality in my approach. It's an operational equivalence relation.
Okay. Yes.
But maybe I should just say that there is potential for confusion because...
Because the word contextuality appears twice.
Yeah,
that's I wasn't sure whether I should say it or not.
Sometimes people use the word non-contextuality to refer to operational facts. Like,
yes.
It doesn't matter whether this projector appears in one set or another set. It gets the same probabilities in quantum theory. So in that sense, you could say, okay, it's the Born rule is a non-contextual assignment.
And then there is the next question of contextuality.
So just to be clear, so this is not the ontological notion of non-contextuality, you're just talking about the operational notion.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Okay. So we assume this condition, whichever way of looking at it we have, we assume this condition, and then we care about those probability distributions that are compatible with a hidden variable and with the predetermined specification of the answer. I don't take you through the equations. These equations are just telling that the answer is a function of the question and of the hidden variable, and the function has the property, again, that the answer doesn't depend on the particular question in which that answer appears. So this is, but without the equation, this is just telling you that nature had a predetermined strategy to answer. So we want to distinguish whether or not this is the case. So we can think of this as a game. We can imagine that there is a probability distribution over the questions. So there is a Px, probability distribution over the question x. There is some set of payoff coefficients that say, tell to nature how much nature wins if she answers in the way we like. And we can compute the expected payoff, so the average of the payoff over the probability distribution of questions and answers. And whenever you have a set of strategies of probability distribution, you can consider the maximum payoff in the game you chose. And this would be a measure of the amount of contextuality that we have. So that's the quantitative sense in which we talk about contextuality here. We define some game between nature and the experimenter, and we want to see how much nature can win somehow, right? want to see what is the maximum payoff that nature can get by using some particular set of strategies. Okay? And now we talk which sets. Okay? So that's the game. So now there are three important values, at least three, possibly more. So one value is the maximum payoff that you can get if the answers are predetermined. So I call it omega C, because this sounds like the classical payoff. Although we are not really talking about classical, we're talking mostly about predetermined. So this is the maximum that nature can do if nature has to decide the answer before you ask the question. Then there is omega Q. This is the maximum payoff you can get if the response of nature is based on quantum mechanics, on the fact that there is a system in a quantum state, and the way to produce the answers is to measure that system with a projective quantum measurement. So you can consider the maximum over the probability distributions that are generated in this way, and this will give you one value, omega Q. So that's another important value. The third value is just the maximum you can get if you don't put any restriction, except the restriction I showed before, the one we discussed with Rob for a couple of minutes. So unless if you consider every probability distribution that satisfies that condition, that Rob called the operational equivalence, if you maximize over all of them, you will get some value that will depend on the game, and this is really the maximum you can think of under that condition. Okay? These are the three important values. So the key observation is that the quantum value is sandwiched between the value that you get with a predetermined answer and the maximum value, and you can find games where these inequalities are strict. So where quantum mechanics give you strictly more than what a predefined answer will give you, and this is the Cauchy-Specker scenario or the Bell's theorem. So there are cases where you really have a strict inequality, and there are also cases where you get strictly less than what you could possibly get from all possible strategies. And there are examples like this. Even Thirlson bound is an example of that. The fact that you could get 4 in principle, but you only get 2 root 2 is an example of that, if you phrase non-locality in the framework of games for contextuality. So now the question, the technical question is, can we find some physical principles that determine omega Q? So this is the technical problem that many of us have been interested in. Well, many probably means more than 4. We're not that many, but there's many, some of us, okay? So this is the question. Can we find some physical principle that explain why omega Q has this specific value, which is not the predetermined answer value, is not the maximum value? So why are we exactly in that particular point of the contextuality space? Okay, so now we enter in the core of my talk. So there is a big caveat, and many of you know this already. So what is the big caveat? The caveat is that the restriction to projective measurements is essential to define omega Q. It doesn't really make sense to talk about omega Q without the restriction to projective measurements, because if you don't make that restriction, if you allow for arbitrary quantum measurements, aka POVMs, then you always get the maximum value. Like for every possible game, the maximum over all POVMs is the same as the maximum over all conceivable strategies. This is a pretty basic thing. I personally learned it by being the referee of Anna's PhD thesis, so that's the place where I learned it. I suspect that probably some other people said it, I don't know. But this is a pretty basic thing to know. So it's really vital that we are talking about projective measurements and not about every measurement, because otherwise there is not even a problem to solve. Otherwise the maximum is just the maximum for every theory. Okay, even for classical theory you can get there, because those values are things that you can get by probability distributions. So now, yes, it is really the restriction to projective measurement that makes the whole problem meaningful. Otherwise, we don't talk about this problem at all. Then we have to talk about contextuality in a different sense. Okay? So this leads us to 3 important and related issues. The first issue is, like, why do we care at all about projective measurements? Right? After all, projective measurements are not the best measurement that exist. I mean, there are some POVMs that are better than projective measurements for some tasks you may care about, like state discrimination. If you have three states on a plane for a qubit, the best measurement is proven to be not projective. Use a POVM, that's the best you can do. So, like, it's not that projective measurements are the best for everything you try to do. So why do we care at all about this? So, like, people like Koshin and Speicher, people who are doing quantum logic, they had a very good reason to care. Because for them, projectors represented propositions or properties of nature, and what was at stake with the contextuality was the possibility to assign truth values to these propositions, or the possibility to assign properties to systems. So I think that was really the reason why projective measurements were so important at that time. There is also a contingent reason, is that at the time, literally, the other measurements were not considered yet. So POVMs started to be considered pretty much in the 70s, well, depending on the country, in some countries maybe earlier and in some countries later, but there are also historical reasons. But I think the main conceptual reason is that people cared about projective measurements because of this correspondence with propositions and properties of systems. So now, many years have passed, and many of us here don't come from that school of thought. So for many of us, now what about us? Why do we care about projective measurements now? People in quantum information, for example. So since I'm not too late, I would like to give you like a couple of minutes to give some answers. Like, why do you care about projective? For those who cared about this problem, can you give on the top of your head one reason why you cared about projective measurements?
Well, you just said the ideal measurements.
Okay, well, thanks. That's, that helps me a lot to get to the point. Any other proposal? Well, any other sense in which they are ideal, of course. That's one reason to me to say we care. Ideal just means they are beautiful, so we care about them. So why they are? What makes them ideal for you?
Can't you violate any POVM strategy to?
That's a good, interesting point. So they seem to have a privileged role in the structure of measurements, because at least the others can be derived from them. So in a sense, this could be a reason to care about. Any other answer? Yes, so that's another very good reason why I would care about them, because if you want to talk about things that are as close as possible to talking about properties, at least you want a notion of repeatability. At least if you do it twice, you would like to get the same outcome. Again, that's enough of a poll, unless anybody really dies of the desire of expressing another reason why he cared about projecting. No? Enough? Okay. Okay, so that's one important thing. First of all, why do we care? So can we just distill some operational reasons why projective measurement means something to us as people who have been working in quantum information, as opposed of like doing the traditional quantum logic a la von Neumann with the lattice of projectors and all of that? That was the first issue. The second issue is like, okay, what is a projective measurement outside quantum theory? So if you want to derive the quantum value of contextuality, and now you know that that value is about projective measurements, what does it mean to go outside quantum theory if you don't know what a projective measurement is outside quantum theory? So in order to derive the quantum value for contextuality, we must go outside quantum theory. And if we go outside quantum theory, we must restrict the maximization to some special type of measurement. This is mathematical, so we must, because if you don't do it, we just get the maximum value in every physical theory. Right? So we must restrict to some special type of measurements. So now the question is like, which measurements? Some set of measurements that in quantum theory would become the projective measurement. So the issue here is like, what type of measurements? And what is the definition of projective measurement if you are in a theory that is not quantum mechanics, so you don't have projectors? What is a projective measurement without projectors? Okay. That's the second issue. The third issue is more subtle, but even more interesting, perhaps. So bear with me, because this one will have more than one slide. So what counts as a compelling physical principle when you try to find fundamental principle for contextuality in this Koshin-Speicher scenario? So one that was recognized to be fundamental over time, in history at least, was what is called the exclusivity principle, or consistent exclusivity, or any other things. So here we'll just call it exclusivity or E principle. So roughly, the principle tells you that if there are two events, if there is a set of events, and every two of them are mutually exclusive, whatever you mean by that, then all the events in the set should be exclusive with each other. Okay? So if they are exclusive pairwise, they are exclusive globally. So this was already stated by acknowledged by Specker in one of his first papers on this topic. This became pretty much a big deal in quantum logics. This was called orthocoherence there. Apparently, they had a particular taste for names that do not much suggest what the principle is about. But I don't know who is the first person who talked about this, but you start to see this, I think, from the mid-60s onwards. So that's been there forever. Even in quantum logic, people often said this is something that is important, but we don't know how to justify it. That was written in many quantum logics books or articles. So this came back to life later with Adan. Well, somehow the story is more complicated, but let me restrict to this thing. So it came back with Adan and Joe Anson, who spelled it out again in kind of the language that we would use now. So this is surely historically has been an important principle. Besides any matter of taste, I mean, even if you don't like it, it has been there. People did care about it. People did care about the fact that there was a reason for understanding this in a more compelling way, and it's kind of historically relevant. So in a particular comment on this come apart from one of our distinguished, well, probably from the most distinguished speaker of this conference, so Professor Koshin. So I found this quote from him saying that he and Specker spent many hours discussing the principle, and the difficulty was in trying to justify it on general physical grounds, without already assuming the Hilbert space formalism. And well, this was not found at that time. So I was talking with Professor Koshin over lunch. Now he would have actually a way to justify it. But at that time, apparently, this was not yet there. And to be completely clear, this is a quote coming from another distinguished speaker of this conference. You can find the quote in this archive paper. So I wasn't there when this was said. This is something that comes from a paper of Adan, just to put myself on a safe side. Okay, that's something that gives the feeling that it has been there, and there was a need of a better understanding of it. Besides, if you, as I said, you can find statements like this in books on quantum logic. So I was randomly looking yesterday. I found this about orthocoherence there in the book by Wills, Cook, and Moore, kind of current trends in operational quantum logics. And there is a statement, there is a chapter on orthocoherence. One of the first statements is like, people never provided a compelling justification of that. Okay, so it's not that the reason, the interest is like hanging on this particular quote. It's something that was generally recognized as important but problematic. So what I would like to argue is that the reason why it was problematic is that the framework was different. So somehow, after 50 years of Koshin's Baker's theorem, we started asking different questions. And by asking different questions, sometimes things that were hard before become more natural now. So I don't think that we are any smarter now, that we find solutions to things that were not found before. It's just over 50 years, many things changed, and the way people look at things became different. So let me try to give you the feeling of what I mean. So let's think of what the exclusivity principle is really saying if you represent it in the pure graph theoretic framework. So here there are three questions. Blue, red, and green, that each have three answers. So you can see that A and B are mutually exclusive answers because they belong to the same question. So either you answer A or you answer B, so they are mutually exclusive. So also A and 1 are mutually exclusive because A and 1 belong to the green question, so you can either answer A or answer 1. And so it is for B and 1 because they belong to the red question. So either you answer B or you answer 1, but not both. So the exclusivity principle boils down to the fact that the sum of the three probabilities should be smaller than one. If this is all it is, I don't even feel that this should be a law of nature. I mean, why should it ever be a law of nature that whenever you have questions like this, the sum of the probabilities should have this property? I think the reason why it was hard to find the compelling reason is that in this framework, there is no compelling reason. And let me argue even more about that with a little example. Let's think that these three questions are actually practical questions about three lotteries that we can play. So now the answers are the amount of money that you win. So how much money nature will give you? $100, $200 or zero, $100, $400 or zero, $200, $400 minus $200. So these are three lotteries. And nature set up this lottery in such a way that if you want to play one of them, you have these probabilities. These probabilities guarantee to you that the choice of lottery is fair. So no matter which lottery you choose, your expected payoff is the same in every lottery. Okay? So that's a problem where you can apply the graph theoretic scenario. I mean, it's not the problem we had in mind of projective measurement, but if you just think about this thing of answers and questions, this is a fair thing. This is a fair choice, and it violates the E-principle. So there is nothing wrong with the fact that it violates the E-principle. What is wrong is that this operational situation of playing three lotteries is not the situation that we have in mind when we talk about projective measurements. So somehow the fact that what we are talking about starts to matter here. It's not just the naked graph that tells you what should be true or what should not be true, but you need really to specify in a more physical and more direct way what these answers are about and what the questions are about. So this is the point I wanted to make. So if you want to go to find a justification of the E-principle, you have to go beyond the bare graph. You need to attach a meaning to the questions and to the answer, because there are situations where actually in the graph you don't have reasons to assume the E-principle. It's even better not to have it, like in the previous example. So to find the justification, we need to remember that in quantum theory, the E-principle is about projective measurements. So to justify it, we need to talk about projective measurements in general theories, because otherwise we don't know even what we are talking about. So, and this is the concrete technical part that I wanted to present. So we can have one definition of projective measurements in general probabilistic theories that somehow leads you naturally to the E-principle. So the first ingredient in our definition is repeatability. That was one of the things naturally mentioned before, like Rob mentioned it. We didn't agree that in advance. So I didn't pay him for saying repeatability. So that's one of the ingredients that I would put in what is the special property of the measurements we like. So what does it mean, repeatability? You can consider a demolition measurement where you get your system, you measure it, and you don't care about what is after. So for what it matters for you, the system could have been destroyed or demolished. So you only care about the probability of the outcomes. You can do that, or you can talk about non-demolition measurement where the system is still there after the measurement. Okay? So graphically, we can represent the two measurements in this way. Here there is nothing after the measurement. Here there is a system. There is still a system after the measurement. So repeatability is about realizing measurements in a non-demolition way so that you can get the same outcome if you do the measurement twice. So you can define a measurement to be repeatable if the demolition measurement has a non-demolition realization so that this is true. So you first apply the non-demolition version, you get outcome I, then you apply the demolition version. And getting outcome I later is the same as getting outcome I before. So that's one way to define repeatability. There are other ways. They are all equivalent to this. So repeatability is a very uncontroversial notion here. So I just like this because it's simple. Because it's almost like an eigenvector condition. It's like saying that this formal thing is an eigenvector of this other formal thing. So in short, you want the same result when you perform the measurement multiple times. Okay? That's repeatability. So the next ingredient in the definition of the special measurement I care about is minimal disturbance. And this requires a little bit more of explanation. What do we mean by disturbance and what do we mean by minimal? So what do I mean by no disturbance? So we can say that the measurement M, demolition measurement M, does not disturb the demolition measurement N if there is some non-demolition realization of M with this property. So if you first perform the non-demolition measurement of M, and then you perform N, and you forget about the outcomes of the first, this is the same as measuring N directly. So this condition tells you that measuring this demolition, the non-demolition measurement M, does not disturb the measurement N. Because if you ignore the outcome of the first measurement, this was like not doing it at all. The second condition tells you that if you ignore the outcome of the second measurement, this was like doing the first measurement. This is just telling you that this non-demolition measurement M is a realization of the demolition measurement of small m. Right? So this is non-disturbance, and this is just the fact that you are measuring M. Okay? So since there is more than one equation, just ask, is everybody on page here? Did you follow what I mean? Okay? So no disturbance, and just the fact that you are measuring M. So that's the definition of no disturbance. So now notice one thing. If this is true, then it means that small m and small n are compatible, okay? Because this operational strategy of first applying the non-demolition measurement M and then N is a joint measurement for both. I mean, these two equations just tell you that you have a joint measurement by definition. This tells you that this joint measurement, if you coarse grain over I, gives you a measurement of N. They say that the joint measurement, if you coarse grain over J, gives you a measurement of M. So by definition, if M does not disturb N, they must be compatible. Okay? That's obvious from the definition. So they are jointly measurable. So my notion of minimal disturbance is that a measurement is minimally disturbing if it only disturbs those measurements that it has to disturb. So if it doesn't disturb the measurements that are compatible with it, it only disturbs those that are not compatible. Because again, by definition, we know that the measurements that are not compatible must be disturbed. Okay? If they were not disturbed, they would be compatible.
So would you say non-disturbance is the definition of compatibility here?
Well, compatibility has an independent definition.
Okay. Do you use that?
Sorry?
Do you need that?
Yeah. Well, I'm just saying that that definition is satisfied. So yes, I'm using it. I'm saying.
You just need your definition by compatibility.
Yes. It means that there is a refinement of both measurements that if you marginalize over one outcome, it gives you one measurement. If you marginalize... Sorry?
This is a particular kind of
refinement.
Yeah, and this is a particular way of achieving that. So it's like an implication. If you don't disturb, you have a joint measurement. Doesn't mean that every joint measurement can be realized in this way. That's interesting, but not relevant here.
That's all.
Thanks. Okay, so that's the definition of minimally disturbing. It means that doing the measurement does not preclude the possibility of extracting a finer information later. So this informal statement is really the guiding idea for the contextuality thing. The fact that you don't preclude what will come, extracting more precise information later. Okay, so how do I define a sharp measurement? So the generalization of a projective measurement. If it is repeatable and minimally disturbing. In quantum theory, you can prove a theorem that sharp in this sense is the same as projective measurement. So this is like a one-to-one characterization of the projective measurements in quantum theory.
Sorry, minimally disturbing was it disturbs the least?
It disturbs only the measurements that are incompatible with it. Because it has to disturb them. So minimally it means that it doesn't disturb anything else except what it has to disturb.
But it can't disturb measurements that are compatible, otherwise they wouldn't be compatible.
No, because that implication doesn't work the other way around.
It's not the same thing.
So I'm imposing that it is. So that's what I'm asking.
Right.
I'm asking that is the case. Whenever they are compatible, they can be compatible in this special way. So that's one way of understanding what I'm asking. The minimal disturbance property allows you to identify the fact that there exists a joint measurement with the fact that you can measure one and then the other.
So it's like commutativity is the same as compatibility for projective measurement.
Yes, mm-hmm.
So I'm imposing that. That's part of what I'm requiring. Okay. Yes?
Can you explain briefly, why does repeatability not just follow from the middle of disturbance?
Oh, that's an important thing. Well, as many things, unfortunately, there are many important things here. If you just take this one, minimal disturbance tells you, in quantum theory, that the measurement operators are proportional to projectors. So the proportionality constant could be smaller than one. So like, if you take the identity and you randomize, just like toss a coin and don't do anything, that's minimally disturbing. But it's not repeatable, because every time you toss the coin, you can get some different outcomes. So repeatability just tells you that the proportionality constant is one in quantum theory. Okay. Okay, so now we can finally define contextuality. I mean, we can finally say what we mean by studying the problem of contextuality. So given a contextuality game, we can consider the maximum payoff we can get by strategies that are generated in this special way. By preparing a state in our generalized physical theory and applying a sharp measurement. Okay? Like the same way we did in quantum theory, now we put a sharp measurement, this, and this is our restricted set of conditional probability distributions. So in this way we can say that the theory is contextual, is the maximum value you can get with these strategies, is above the value that comes from predetermined outcomes. So see, we are towards the end of my talk, and we finally managed to define what we mean by contextuality in a generalized probabilistic theory. There was quite some work to be done here before we even talk about what we mean. Okay, so let me just mention that there are other definitions of sharp measurement, at least three. One is like measurements that are made of extremal effect. This was actually came in a paper by Holevoy in 85, and this notion was used by Cavelio, Severini, Winter in their graph theoretic paper to define what they mean by the maximum over general probabilistic theories. There is another definition that basically goes back to Hardy, like you can call sharp those measurements that distinguish as many states as they could distinguish, that they distinguish the maximum possible set of states. And there are also measurements that are coarse graining of pure orthogonal measurements. That's another notion you can define. So this is only to tell you that there are other definitions. As far as I know, none of these definitions leads you directly to the E principle. All of them leads you to the E principle indirectly. There are, well, all maybe except the first, but at least the second two lead to the E principle through some extra axioms that are not about measurements. So, there are many definitions. In quantum theory, they are all the same. Outside quantum theory, we really don't know. So this slide is just to bring you into the hell of people doing general probabilistic theories, because things that are the same in quantum theory, most of the times they are not the same outside quantum theory. And the counterexample could be arbitrarily convoluted and arbitrarily uninteresting, except for the fact that it is a counterexample and it exists. So the only point of it is being a counterexample. But be gentle when you referee a paper of people like us. You don't. We don't have to find a counterexample for every weird principle and every weird thing that we are doing. It's more productive to try to look for the right thing to do. Okay. So, and I will actually give you an answer in a couple of. Some answer also to the question of the equivalence of this in a few minutes, if I can get there, probably not. So now we can mention a physical reason for the exclusivity principle. sorry, what have I done here? Okay, so the first thing that we restrict ourselves to theories that are causal, in the sense that the probability of outcomes for measurements we do now at time t do not depend on the settings of measurements we will do at time t prime. That's an assumption. That's how general you get in general probabilistic theories. That's an assumption. And I will make this assumption, and I will not say it again. I say it once. From now on, I assume causality. So the first thing that I assume is an axiom that says that less information, if you extract less information, you should have a measurement that is even more sharp than the measurement you had before. What does it mean technically is that if you have a sharp measurement, a repeatable and minimally disturbing measurement, coarse graining it should still leave it a sharp measurement. So it should remain repeatable and should still have the feature that has minimal disturbance. Adam was asking why more sharpness? Because when you coarse grain, you generate more things that are compatible. So being non-disturbing for the things after coarse graining is a stronger condition. So you are making things more sharp by doing this. That's the axiom. I think it's natural to the point that from some point of view is not even an axiom. If you take the point of view of mathematicians, a measurement is not just an assignment of probabilities to individual outcomes. A measurement is an assignment of probability to subsets of outcomes. If you define a sharp measurement in that way, that's just a part of the definition. That's what it means to have a sharp measurement that assigns probabilities to sets, not only to individual outcomes. So that's the definition of sharp measurement in a sense, not even an axiom. So the example is if you have three outcomes and you sum two of them, whatever sum means here, I didn't explain that, but you just coarse grain them, you look at them together, they should be still sharp. And this can be included in the definition, I just said. So first theorem is that if you assume this, which pretty much means if you assume nothing except the definition of sharp measurement, you get the principle. Put in another way, this means that you do have the principle in all the theory, in all the situation where you care about asking the question, what is the amount of contextuality you have there. So it's not a feature of quantum mechanics in any sense, it's a feature of every theory where you decide that you care about this particular type of measurements. Okay, the next thing you can do is you can define a hierarchy of principles based on consistent exclusivity. You can apply it at the many copy level. I will gloss over the technical details because I think I have 5 minutes, right? Yeah. So anyways, I couldn't even explain this in technical details. So for those who know, you know what you're talking about. For those who don't, there is some extension of the exclusivity principle to multipartite settings. This defines stronger restrictions. And we can prove that if you assume that sharp measurements are local. So whenever I give you a sharp measurement for system A and a sharp measurement for system B, I look at the two together as a measurement on the composite system. The property is that this is a sharp measurement. Okay? Again, general probabilistic theories are so crazy that this may not be true. So that's an axiom, you have to ask for it. So after you acknowledge that this is an axiom, this just gives you all the levels of the hierarchy of consistent exclusivity, pretty much for free, just by requiring that the product of sharp measurement is sharp. There is another principle, okay, and from these things, actually, you can get quantitative bounds like Kliasko inequality, or even the Ziresol bound in some sense that Adam has shown, so you can really find numbers out of these pretty much high-level theoretical ideals. Well, you, Adam, can do. I couldn't do that, so I'm glad that somebody else did it. So the other thing is that you can go from sharp measurement to arbitrary measurements. And what you do there is another principle that is local orthogonality. This is pretty much like exclusivity, but it is for arbitrary measurements, and it is in the multipartite settings. For the record, this is what got me interested in the problem from the beginning. So I first thought about local orthogonality, and then I came to know about exclusivity. So that's again the same as the E principle, but now for all possible measurements. Still, we can reduce even this to the properties of sharp measurements, because as somebody said before, in quantum theory, every measurement can be reduced to a sharp measurement by extension. So we just ask this as an axiom for the moment. Why don't we ask that every measurement you can find in our theory can be extended to a sharp measurement on a composite system when you just throw in some extra degree of freedom? If we do that, then we get we get local orthogonality for free at all possible levels of the hierarchy. So all these limitations on the convex set are pretty much natural consequences of the idea that we care about sharp measurements, and sharp measurements have some special properties. Okay? The last axiom, this sharpization of measurements, brought me back to the purification philosophy at the beginning of the talk. Okay? That was like my inspiration. I didn't prove any theorem on that, but that was the guiding principle, that We go from non-ideal features of local systems to ideal features of composite systems. How does it really match with this big picture that I was saying? So let's try to combine purification of states with the sharpness of measurements. Combine axioms doesn't mean that you just throw them together. Axioms interact. You have to combine them. It's an art to combine them. So the way I would combine them is this. So imagine that you live in a world where every state can be dilated to a pure state. So now, what do you want to be true about measurements? Of course, you want sharp measurement to exist. So, but now imagine that there exists just one sharp measurement with a property that when you look at one part of a pure state, for every outcome, you get a pure state in the rest of the world. So you are floating in this pure world. You look at one part of it, and for every outcome you get, you leave the rest of the world in a pure state. You preserve the purity of the world. Imagine, thanks a lot. Imagine that this is true.
I was trying to be helpful.
You have been, actually. Now we need, yes. If this is true, you get a new theorem that tells you this. If you have just purification of states and one ideal measurement that is sharp and purification preserving, then you get for free fundamental sharpness, locality of sharp measurement, no information, more sharpness, and all the four alternative definitions of sharp measurements I showed before collapse to only one definition. So they are all the same if you put yourself in this picture. So that's a theorem. I have a proof, although it's not published yet, but it does exist. So this also led me to a conjecture. It's an informed conjecture. It's based on partial proof that I tried to work out. If you just combine purification and one ideal measurement, you really can show that the exact values of correlations and contextuality games you get are the quantum ones. So to keep things on a calm and modest way, just take this as a conjecture, but it's an informed conjecture, not a crazy one. So this brings me back to the initial picture. The kind of guiding idea I would take about contextuality is that, again, it comes from the tension between two different applications of the purification philosophy. On one hand, you want to purify states. This makes things contextual. On the other hand, you want to have sharp and ideal measurement, and this makes things less contextual, because sharp measurement makes things more classical. So again, the motto could really be that purification brings contextuality in and sharpness cuts it down. So that's all. This is a summary of the results. I don't think I need to read it aloud. I mean, these are the basic things. Well, maybe I should read it aloud. So to talk about contextuality in general probabilistic theory, you have to settle, to make up your mind of what is a sharp measurement in general probabilistic theory. You shouldn't talk about that before you have decided what you are talking about, because that's literally what it is. You can get the E principle and local orthogonality from properties of a particular definition of sharp measurements that I personally happen to like. And if you do more work, if you combine that with purification, there is some evidence that you may actually get to the quantum set exactly. And to conclude, these are the references for the talk. So the first is a long framework paper. The second is a short paper about the results I presented on sharp measurement. Thank you very much for your attention.
So would you agree that, so let's say I want to do an experiment, and I want to sort of use Korsen-Specker inequalities as a test for contextuality. And since you argued that it only applies to the case of sharp measurements in GCPs, I should really confirm that the measurements I've done in the lab are sharp by verifying no disturbance and repeatability for them before I sort of compute any correlations, right? Do you agree with that? That's
not entirely. So I think there are two different levels of discussion. All these things I was saying were not about experiments. They're about the high-level principles that the theory should satisfy.
Yes.
So the way I think of sharp measurement is pretty much the way that has been mentioned by Bayadani in his talk. So it's an idealization. They are not there when you do them. We don't have access to sharp measurement the same way as we don't have inertial reference frames. We don't have no friction. There are many idealizations that are helpful to phrase the structure of the theory. So now, if you want to do an experiment, that's a very good question, but it's a question that people have tried to answer with different methods and has little to do with what I have been doing. So there, you are saying you needed to test repeatability and no disturbance.
I mean,
that would be the direct way to do that.
I think that would be what you
one way.
Do if you want to take the inequalities as a serious witness for
syntax-varying experiment. Yes.
Because you need to verify that your measurements are.
If you want to verify the predetermination sort of thing.
Right. You just want to verify the two things of no disturbance and repeatability.
You may try to do that and see that it is approximately satisfied. So this brings you to the problem of approximate things. Then there have been proposals. I'm not an expert of that, so I don't even feel that I should comment on that because I don't know this thing. But what I want to say is that at the level of principle, if to define what we are talking about, you must define sharp measurement.
Okay.
Just to define that problem. Doesn't matter how you study that in the experiment. That's another question, and I see...
I prefer to allow them to you
because
he was arguing that the reason you should take these inequalities seriously is because, you know, there is this thing called sharpness which can be defined for GPDs.
Mm-hmm.
And from there, as you have shown, you can obtain the exclusivity principle.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the thing is, my question is that in an experiment, if you don't actually verify that the measurements you've done are sharp, why should you take these inequalities as serious witness for contextuality, unless you verify the two conditions of no disturbance and repeatability?
May I answer? This is exactly what we do. Take the last experiment, Zurich, ETH, the whole bunch of the first part.
And you get exact repeatability and you get exact...
You have 99.8. And now let me add something else. Which is in Bell inequalities, in Bell inequality experiments, you have typically signaling. This is the statement of Nicolas Gissin. 90% of the Bell experiments have signaling. Does it mean what?
Guys, I think I will overstep the chairman. I think that's more a question of your interest. It's not about my talk and not about what we are talking about. Yes.
Talk about it, you can do it at a coffee break.
Yes.
We are already in it, so perhaps two more questions.
The last question about the E principle, which we had in conversation many years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm trying to figure out how this fact fits in with what you've shown. So if you constrain yourself with notions of compatibility that go beyond just joint simulatability and move to compatibility would be, there exists some other measurement that can simulate both of the measurements you have in mind, therefore they're compatible. That would be the joint simulatability notion.
Yes.
But then there's these other notions, like the statistics of your measurements are invariant under sequential reordering of the measurements. So that involves... if you're measuring A and then B in sequence, and you can, it's what you were talking about. And then you can change it to measuring B and then A.
Yes.
If you see that the statistics are the same, regardless of what order you put them in, which was on one of your slides, then that's a different notion of compatibility.
Probably yes. I must say I'm not entirely following the full thing, but it sounds like yes.
I think it's the notion of compatibility that you're using here. And it is different because...
The notion of compatibility I'm using is literally there exists another measurement with outcomes I and J.
Okay.
If you marginalize over I, you get the outcome for J.
That's the
one I'm using. That's the
joint simulatability notion.
Yes.
Okay. So it seems to me you're saying instead of asking whether the E principle holds, for example, does pairwise compatibility in that sense imply triplewise compatibility in that sense,
mm-hmm.
you shift the question. You say, let's talk about a smaller set of measurements. Because even in quantum mechanics, with POVMs,
that's a very good point. Yes.
So,
yes.
But my question is this, that if that's the game, if we're allowed to say, well, let's consider a restricted set of measurements, then there's an obvious restriction on measurements that makes the E principle very trivial to
mm-hmm.
derive, which is, suppose that I have two measurements that not only are the statistics the same under reordering, but furthermore, the transformation that they implement on the system is the same regardless of what order you implement.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so take that notion of compatibility. Then, to get from pairwise compatibility to triplewise compatibility, I just noticed that there are six possible orderings. Let's say I have three measurements,
mm-hmm.
and I want to just consider them in all possible orderings,
mm-hmm.
like A, B, and then C, or then A, C, and then B,
mm-hmm.
or C, A, B, and so on. There's six of them.
Yeah.
I can just use the pairwise reordering to derive the triplewise reordering. It's very simple, right?
Yes.
So my question is, how does what you've done fit with this very kind of trivial truth of the E principle for this even more restrictive notion of compatibility?
So, as you said it, this is a different notion.
Yes.
And I don't see any way to derive the thing you said from just the three axioms about Sharp measurement I showed. But I'm not too concerned about that, because that was like, this is like a detective work. You know, we try to learn which measurement, this idea of Sharp measurement in this sense, to use it to do something else, so that to combine it with purification. So the thing that makes me feel confident that if I combine the notion I had with purification, then I can prove also what you are saying. So you can show, like, even with the transformations, there is no disturbance. So, yes, so I don't think you can prove that you have that property from just the definition of Sharp measurement, but if you bring it back to the big picture where of this extension, this idea of extension, then that would be, become true. So, okay, no, nothing. So that definition of yours, I think, would probably still give you the principle, no? You did claim that, no?
Yeah, the stronger notion. Yes. I'm saying it's, and the proof is trivial. The proof is very easy.
Yes, yes, yes. Yeah, I think that's matching with the discussion we were having over lunch, probably. That if one doesn't, like, impose no disturbance at all, even on the final state, whichever order we do the thing, yes, that would definitely lead directly to the E principle. So in a certain sense, if I have to sell what I have it more than I have done already, I could say that this definition that is kind of more modest, requires less, will give you the same after you combine this with purification, which is something I definitely want to do, you may not want to do, but I find that this combination of the two things together makes everything kind of logical and nice. Yeah.
This is a short question. So, Julia, at the beginning you had this quantification of context, was it like omega, so predetermined, quantum, and then the general? Quantum is between double and upper bound. Mm-hmm. Then you were saying that later, in any theory, if you take all observables, I mean quantum theory, you hit the upper bound.
No, I didn't say, sorry. Yes. You hit the upper bound if you don't restrict it to some special set of measurements. Yes.
Because you said that. That is valid in any GPT.
Yeah.
So is it also in classical case?
Sure.
So also in predetermined.
Can I be lazy and leave the answer to the chairman? Because that's where I learned this thing.
So
yes.
How would be the predetermined without restrictions?
Even classically, you have a notion of Sharp measurement. You are talking about like response functions that are like flat, either 0 or 1. Classically, you could have fuzzy measurement where the hidden variable has one value, depending on that you randomize things. So you can
and
have...
And really hits the upper bound if you don't put that restriction.
Yes, that's... If you try to see it, like after 5 minutes, you'll see it's a pretty basic thing. So after you see it once, it's like, of course, like every theory can do that. Because you just...
Can I get your PhD thesis?
Okay. I mean, should I tell you the answer? The answer is, you take the assignment of probability that gets the maximum, you multiply this by the identity or by the deterministic effect, this will define measurements, those measurements reach the maximum. So like the POVM identity times the probability that reaches a maximum is a POVM. So it's very trivial, it's just the identity. There is nothing more, there is no clever trick, it's just that we normally don't think about it. So it sounds strange the first time you hear, but it's actually a very, very basic thing.
Okay, we are kind of already halfway through the coffee break, so I suggest